This week on Making Contact.
We were invaded 23 years ago. We've had more people killed than they've had killed there. Why the double standard?
As soon as Ambassador Abdullah Al-Ashtal from Yemen had put down his hand after the vote, there was a U.S. diplomat at his side saying, "That will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast."
U.S. officials have been extolling the success of NATO's 11-week bombing campaign against Yugoslavia last spring. Throughout the attacks, which killed thousands of Serb civilians and troops, the Clinton administration maintained that NATO forces were acting for humanitarian reasons. There's no doubt the Yugoslav expulsion of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo was brutal, but what's the U.S. track record on fighting for human rights? On this program, we take a look at some examples of U.S. foreign policy goals that shed light on this question. I'm Philip Babbage, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In early June of this year, NATO generals signed a peace agreement with Yugoslavia. Shortly afterwards, Howard Zinn, professor of history at Boston University and author of A People's History of the United States, spoke with Mike Thornton and Eric Siljak for the radio program Full Logic Reverse.
The one thing that I am concerned about is that some people will draw from this the lesson, which will be a wrong lesson, and that is that violence works, that bombing works. And I don't think that's a lesson that we want this generation or future generations to learn. In my opinion, we could have resolved the conflict in Yugoslavia, in Kosovo, without the thousands of deaths that have occurred, civilian and military, in these 10 weeks of bombing.
It comes to my mind that all this is on the assumption that our real goal was to prevent humanitarian catastrophe and to help Kosovo settle down. But after 70-plus days of this bombing, I come to understand that there were a little bit different goals for NATO, and chief goal was really to occupy Kosovo and introduce international protectorate, like what's happening in Bosnia.
Given the history of United States foreign policy for decades now, it was clear to me from the beginning that our main objective was not humanitarian. It would be hard to believe, after all of the actions that the United States has engaged in, which have been anti-humanitarian, and by that I mean, you know, the support of ethnic cleansing in Turkey, the support of ethnic cleansing in Indonesia, the support of ethnic cleansing in Palestine, will be the support of dictatorships in various parts of the world, the maintenance of an economic sanctions on Iraq, which have resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Hard to believe that suddenly the United States had a moral turnabout, and that now its main objective was a moral one. I think the fact that Milosevic was engaged in a rampage of killing and expulsion of Kosovars from Albania gave the situation sort of a moral cover, but it was a cover.
Howard, it's really interesting that you bring up some of the topics you bring. I happen to be scanning the internet this morning, and I found a story by AP. It's very short. Let me read it. European Union leaders today selected NATO Secretary General Javier Solana as the EU's first head of foreign and security policy, a new position designed to give the Union more clout on the international scene. The move came a day after EU leaders approved a blueprint for achieving a stronger defense and security role by the end of 2000 to lessen their long-standing reliance on American power. Can you talk a little bit, Howard, about how, you know, we find ourselves where the United States is now, in essence, acting as the enforcement arm of what appears to be corporate power around the world?
Well, since World War II, of course, you know, the United States has been, you know, the preeminent military and economic power in the world. And every move made by the United States in foreign policy has been designed to maintain and, you know, augment that position. And the power has grown, and the economic tentacles of the United States have been spread farther and farther, you know, across the world, with multinational corporations, which are mostly dominated by, you know, American corporations, and various alliances were created, which had the look of being alliances among equals, but which were always alliances dominated by the United States. NATO being, you know, an example of it. And, you know, when you do as you have done recently and bring Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia into the NATO, what you're doing is saying with some glee, well, we've released Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia from the Soviet sphere. There is no more Soviet sphere. And now we have attached them to our sphere, that is the American sphere. We've enlarged our circle of military allies. And also, we've enlarged the number of countries that are going to be coming to the American corporations asking for F-16s and F-17s and F-22s and more, you know, military hardware.
Howard Zinn, speaking with Mike Thornton and Eric Siljak. Critics of U.S. foreign policy regard the situation in Iraq as a prime example of hypocrisy. The U.S. has sidestepped the authority of the United Nations, they say, while at the same time claiming that it has U.N. authorization to carry out bombing missions against Iraq, which began in 1991. In December of 1998, during the holy Islamic holiday of Ramadan, U.S. and British forces launched an intense four-day bombing campaign. The Iraqi government had accused members of the U.N. Weapons Inspection Team, or UNSCOM, of being U.S. spies and stopped cooperating. Later, it was discovered that some members of the team were in fact working for U.S. intelligence agencies, including the CIA. U.S.-led economic sanctions have been devastating to Iraq's general population. It's estimated that at least 100 people, including children, die each day as a result. Although many observers note that the sanctions have not been effective in getting Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to step down, the U.S. position has been quite clear. On May 12, 1996, for example, Leslie Stahl of the CBS network program 60 Minutes posed a question to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Dennis Halliday is a former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. In 1998, Halliday resigned his post as Chief Relief Coordinator for Iraq to give himself the freedom to speak out against the sanctions.
I think it was less to protest, but rather to be free, to speak up and speak the truth, at least as I see it, in terms of sanctions and the impact on the Iraqi people, which one cannot do, you'll understand, as a staff member of the organization, take on the member states. You need to be independent and free, and that's exactly what I've done.
What were you saying? What were the impacts of the sanctions?
Well, the impact is that we have a situation now where thousands of Iraqi children in particular are losing their lives, are dying every month. We have chronic malnutrition, which is damaging the next generation. And frankly, the Iraqi people have been under such pressure for so many years, they've become quite fatalistic. They don't quite believe any missile is targeting them. And if it does, well, that's that. The complaint of most Iraqis, and I've had it officially and from trade union leaders, is that missiles are a preference over slow starvation. And they see sanctions as a slow, everyday event, slowly killing their children and their parents and their vulnerable people. And they find that worse, frankly, than military strikes.
What do you think is behind these attacks against Iraq? Some critics of the sanctions and the attacks against Iraq have raised the issue that the country has nationalized its oil fields. It wants to use proceeds from oil sales to help the country. This is somehow a political threat, really, to the United States and the United States hegemony worldwide.
Yes, there is a perception that that is the fundamental issue here, that Iraq dared to emerge as a developed country. It had the revenue, it has the people, highly trained, often in this country, North America, Europe, has water, which is essential, of course, for sustaining a large population, 23 million. It dared to, as you say, nationalize oil, it went into petrochemicals, it started to look like a force, a regional force within the Middle East, and this apparently was unattractive to Europe and to the United States, and excuses were found, and Saddam Hussein, of course, was put to work to fight the Iranians, which seemed to serve that the purpose of diminishing Iraqi capacity. That didn't work, I guess, entirely, and then we had the Kuwait disaster and then the very severe coalition forces damage on civilian infrastructure, designed, it seems to me, to destroy the country and put it back many, many decades.
Former UN Assistant Secretary General Dennis Halliday. We'll have more on Iraq after this short break.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program can now be heard across the United States and Canada, South Africa, and around the world on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. You can also hear us on the Internet. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tape and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736.
U.S. officials justified the December 1998 airstrikes against Iraq by citing United Nations resolutions. Specifically, they pointed to UN Security Council Resolution 678, which initially authorized military action soon after Iraq invaded Kuwait in August 1990. Author and journalist Phyllis Bennis, a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., says that the U.S. justification is faulty. Resolution 678 first allowed the use of force in 1990 to expel Iraqi troops from Kuwait, but there have been no occupying troops there since 1991.
So in that circumstance, using that resolution is completely false. And in fact, when Ambassador Bill Richardson came out and said, "We've got authorization," the journalists standing there pointed out to him, "No, you don't. Everyone else said, etc., and the resolution itself says, etc." And his answer was, "We think we do." This is solely in the providence of power. The U.S. as the hyperpower can announce what it wants to do in the U.N., and any country that stands against it is going to do so at its peril.
You mentioned some arm twisting and bribing over the Resolution 678 in 1990. Can you talk about that?
Well, the U.S. was very committed to having a very strong vote. It really wanted a unanimous vote in the Security Council. As it happened, it didn't get a unanimous vote, partly because Cuba stood on principle and refused to endorse the U.S. unilateral effort to engage the world in an endorsement of force. And China, which had threatened to veto, was given a bribe, a major bribe, by the United States. China wanted two things. It wanted long-term development assistance, which had been cut off in the wake of the Tiananmen Square massacre a couple of years earlier, and it wanted diplomatic rehabilitation, also following the massacre, which it had been lacking for 2 years. The U.S. announced about a week before the vote that China had just been granted a big chunk of long-term development aid, and the day after the vote announced that the Chinese Prime Minister had just been invited for a high-profile meeting at the White House, thereby announcing a kind of diplomatic rehabilitation. To no one's surprise, who knew about those gifts, shall we say, to China, China abstained on the resolution rather than using its veto. The other, which was perhaps the most egregious, was Yemen, the sole Arab country on the council. Yemen was there representing the entire Arab group and, of course, realized it could not, in any legitimate role, vote to use force by an outside power against a fellow Arab country. So Yemen voted no. And as soon as Ambassador Abdullah Al-Ashtal from Yemen had put down his hand after the vote, there was a U.S. diplomat at his side saying, "That will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast." And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world, a shamefully low aid budget anyway, about $70 million, but in the Yemeni context, very important.
Interesting. Along those same lines, then, maybe you can speak about the role of the United States military industry arming and training foreign countries. And what is this, the talk that President Clinton is putting out that is proposing $112 billion increase for military spending over the next six years? What does this mean for world security?
I think it makes world security much farther away. The U.S. provides 60% of the arms trade in the world. The other permanent members of the Security Council kick in another 25. Together, the five permanent members are responsible for 85% of the world arms trade. That explains a lot of things. It explains, for example, why UNSCOM, when it was created, was prohibited by Security Council resolution, or Security Council agreement, prohibited from making public the records it found in Iraq, and it's found a host of records in Iraq, documenting the sources of Iraq's weapon systems. Now, why is that? Who stands to lose if those weapons, records are released? It's not the problem of Saddam Hussein's government getting them. They already know where they get the weapons. The problem is us. The problem is that if we knew which companies and where they are, if they're in the U.S., if they're in France, wherever they are, we might move to shut them down. And it's precisely to prevent that, to protect those companies, that the U.S. and its allies on the Council are so determined not to go public with those records.
Phyllis Bennis. Her most recent book is titled Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. Former Assistant UN Secretary General Dennis Halliday adds that it's not just the United States to blame for the power imbalance in the United Nations.
The fact is, however, the member states now show no regard for the UN Charter, Declaration of Human Rights, Rights of the Child, Rights to Economic and Social Activity. The resolutions of the Security Council are undermining all of these conventions, and that's yet another tragedy that the United Nations is going to have to address.
Is the United States to blame for this?
Not alone, certainly not.
What are some other countries that may be thrown into this pod?
Well, I think all those countries participating in the Security Council who approve these resolutions, which are designed, for example, to take away the human rights of the Iraqi people. They already have a difficulty with Saddam Hussein, and then we go in and demolish their rights to homes, to family, to food, to education, to health care. I mean, this is criminal. And this is what the member states are now doing to the Iraqis and, in a sense, doing it to the United Nations. The small member states of the United Nations indeed have a difficult time. They do have to compromise because they're bullied by the large powers who have financial and other hold over them. They need their trade, they need their support, whatever. It's very difficult to stand up, I think, for what is right and be principled. I think there's no excuse for Europe and no excuse for North America to get into that situation. I believe firmly that the United States of America, as the only power left in the world, so to speak, has a huge moral responsibility to take leadership. I think that is not happening. I think the opportunity is being lost. I think that for the future, that's what we've got to hope for. If that happens, then I think we'll see a different United Nations, and we'd see a United Nations that has the support of the United States, which is not visible at the moment.
This may be too much of a kind of ethereal question, but what happens to morality at these high levels, these high decision-making levels? Can morality still be a simple matter between right and wrong?
I wish that were so, and it's hard to find it. Compromise is the name of the game. Plus, behind the scenes, as you've implied, there is another huge industrial, military, intelligence force out there, multinational corporations that are answerable to nobody. Often you would think that the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Britain, others, they are really bit players on a bigger screen, which is actually manipulated by others. So that makes you sort of skeptical and concerned about the future of the world. So I would prefer to focus on rebuilding the UN, giving up a fraction of national sovereignty, even for a great country like this one, and finding a way to make the UN work. If we don't have it, as many people have said, we'd have to reinvent it. You've got to communicate with people. If you don't understand and meet and talk to people of all different religions and cultures and backgrounds, you know, we're going to make this world even more unlivable than it is already. Not for us, perhaps, but for many, many people. The vast majority of people are living still in poverty and deprivation, and that is, nobody should be proud of that.
When the United States and its NATO allies made the decision to bomb Yugoslavia in the spring of 1999, A primary justification was to protect the human rights of the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, who were being pushed out of the region by the Yugoslav army. President Clinton and British Prime Minister Tony Blair said that bombing was, quote, the moral thing to do. But when faced with other atrocities on a similar or larger scale, the U.S. government has been much less eager to invoke morality. Take the case of East Timor. In 1975, the Indonesian army invaded the island country of East Timor, a former Dutch colony that's geographically part of the Indonesia archipelago. The day before the invasion, then-President Gerald Ford and then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger had been visiting the military president of Indonesia, General Suharto. Declassified documents reveal that the United States had foreknowledge of the December 7, 1975 invasion.
We need help. Paratroopers are dropping everywhere. At times, nearly hysterical, he said that women and children were being fired on and the Indonesians were killing indiscriminately.
Elderly woman came and she asked to speak to me. She said, "Sister, I want to tell you what's happened in these days, just so you know." I said, "Okay." So she said, "A few days ago, the military came to our house and they took my son away. And they wanted information, so they beat him and they beat him and they beat him until he told them that he had nothing to tell them, right?" So, I said, "What did they do to you?" And they said, "They put cigarettes here, or they put a bamboo. They make him sit that crouch down, but they put a bamboo behind his knees, so it really hurts. And then they tied his feet and they tied their hands. And then they would ask him a question, and he would respond. And if they didn't like the answer, they would kick him, or they would beat him with a rifle butt."
In East Timor, anyone who is arrested is subjected to some of the worst forms of torture. We have this photographic evidence more than one occasion. It's a pattern.
That was an audio excerpt from the video Indonesia, One Struggle, One Change, produced and written by Maria Luisa Mendoza and Medea Benjamin for Global Exchange. You heard the voices of Sister Marlene Bautista and Jose Ramos Horta, co-recipient of the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize. Since that time, the Indonesian military, supplied with weapons and training from the United States, has killed over 200,000 East Timorese, one-third of East Timor's pre-invasion population. Now, after many years of resistance and organizing, the East Timorese have the opportunity to vote on the question of autonomy. One might think this change has brought with it a greater sense of security in East Timor. According to independent reports, however, this is not the case. Paramilitary activity has increased in recent months. Earlier this year, about 200 people were murdered by paramilitary troops in the East Timor town of Lakisa. Billy Nessen, a journalist and longtime peace activist, was in Lakisa just after the attack. He spent 2 months in East Timor researching ties between paramilitary forces and the Indonesian military and police.
These pro-Indonesia militias are funded or started, funded and aided at every step by police and military. In fact, in this town of Lakisa, where many people were killed, the military or the mobile police shot tear gas into the church and into the priest's residence to flush people out. Those people were then hacked and shot to death by the militias and maybe even by the military. In the next few weeks, there were numerous attacks, mobilizations of the militias in the capital city, Dili, and it was clear there that the military and the mobile police were not just aiding them, that they were doing some of the killing themselves.
Nessen says that he believes the Indonesian government wants the paramilitary attacks to shift attention away from its involvement in repressing the independence movement in East Timor.
Now all the attention is on these militias, which is unfortunate, but because it seems as if Indonesia and Indonesian military is not involved. This is just what Indonesia wants. The reason that they gave for having to come to East Timor almost 24 years ago was a civil war, which actually they had funded one side, and their claim today is that if they leave, there will be another civil war, and their proof of it is these militias, which are now supposedly battling pro-independence forces. But it's the hand of the military behind them.
At the same time, says Nesson, the Indonesian military has been trying to ferret out members of East Timor's resistance army, Valentine Guerrillas.
When I was there, I met a man who was subsequently killed in front of his family. They wanted information from him. They cut holes. They cut two holes in his cheeks first with a knife to get him to talk. Then they pulled out each one of his fingernails. Still didn't talk. Then they started cutting off fingers, one finger after another. He eventually admitted to hiding several Falantil guerrillas. That's the independence guerrillas movement. And then they cut out his tongue and killed him. All this in front of his family.
Members of the international solidarity movement for East Timor say there have been some hopeful signs in recent months, despite the military and paramilitary violence. General Suharto was forced out of office in May 1998. Observers say his replacement, B.J. Habibie, is more receptive to change in East Timor. The Indonesian government released East Timorese resistance leader Shenana Gusmao from prison and placed him in house arrest this February. And after heavy grassroots pressure, the U.S. Congress has passed a resolution that effectively bans the use of U.S. weapons in East Timor. Now, says Billy Nesson, the question is, will the U.S. government back the East Timorese if they choose independence in the August referendum?
I would hope that Americans would continue to pay some attention to East Timor and put whatever kind of pressure they can on their government to make sure that there is a fair vote. The United States is key in this whole process. Tomorrow, if Clinton wanted East Timor to have independence and was willing to take some risks with Indonesia, East Timor would have independence. The East Timorese who do have access to the radio and to television ask me, knowing the answer, why do they send all this military to Kosovo and not here? We were invaded 23 years ago. We've had more people killed than they've had killed there. Why the double standard?
Journalist and activist Billy Nesson. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at U.S. foreign policy hypocrisy. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to the A. Amphos Radio Project website, which provided our segment with Howard Zinn via the internet. Stephanie Welch helped write and produce this program. Laura Labadie is our managing director, Peggy Law is executive director, our production assistant is Shireen Meraji, Norman Solomon is senior advisor, our national producer is David Barsamian, and I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.